called the microscopic Andronikashvili experiment, or the rotating bucket experiment, but where the bucket is not macroscopic, it's rather microscopic, and it's a molecule. So you have on the left here in this cartoon a droplet of helium atoms, and in the center of it you have a OCS molecule. It's a rigid linear molecule. And what you can do is do some spectroscopy on this molecule. This molecule has a permanent dipole, and you can cause rho vibrational transitions of this molecule. And they did the experiment in the gas phase. And first, they did an experiment just on the molecule itself. That's a very old experiment. And you get, in the infrared, P and R branches that have to do with the rho vibrational structure of the eigenstates. And it's a very clean spectrum with sharp lines because there's no dissipation. Then they did the experiment in their helium droplet. And in the helium droplet, they used two kinds of helium. They used helium-4, the boson isotope, and helium-3, the fermion. And what they saw is that in helium-4, the spectrum looks like that of an isolated molecule. So they say, hey, the lack of broadening of the lines or the lack of dissipation is due to superfluidity. And this would be some microscopic manifestation of superfluidity. And they did the experiment in helium-3. They didn't see these sharp lines because at the temperature of the experiment, 0.37 Kelvin, helium-3 is not yet a superfluid. So this was very exciting, and it opened up a whole new field of research in chemical physics of dope superfluid clusters. And there's a lot of experiments on helium clusters like that. These are nano droplets, so they contain about 10,000 or more helium atoms. Now, people wanted to understand what happens at the other end of the spectrum. That is, when you have 1, 2, 3, and so on, when you can enumerate the individual helium atoms. So I have a colleague at the University of Alberta who tackled this problem from the bottom up. So he took an OCS molecule, and then he added one by one a helium atom, and he recorded a microwave spectrum. So he could directly probe transitions between a zero angular momentum state for the whole system and a state with one quantum of angular momentum. And if you interpret that as a rigid rotor, the spacing between those energy levels, this gap, is related to B, and this is inversely proportional to the moment of inertia of the system. So you have the effective inertia of the system that goes up, or this B that goes down, as the size of the system increases. But something happened. They went up to 8, and they went below the nanodroplet limit when you have 10,000. So there must be a phenomenon that says that this will turn around and go back up, or the onset of decoupling, or they claim this was the onset of a superfluid response here. So they made the cover of Science with this in 2002. And again, there was a lot of activity following that, in both in theory and in experiments, to try to understand these systems. So this is what I'm going to be talking about here. Most of the results I'm going to show you are theoretical results, simulations, and the quantity that I calculate the most often is B, the rotational constant, or the inertia. And the tool I use is different from the tools we've heard about this morning. I'm a first quantization person. So our Hamiltonian is a first principle Hamiltonian like this. We have a term which is a rotational kinetic energy of a molecule we immerse in our bath of bosons. We have those bosons. This molecule can translate, and it interacts with its environment, all those bosons, with some additive potential that we can calculate ab initio using electronic structure calculation. And the important thing is that this interaction is anisotropic. So it breaks some symmetries. And then we can express a partition function in terms of this Hamiltonian, and all the properties can be obtained from the partition function. And we use a tool called path integral Monte Carlo as a way to sample this partition function. And the properties we calculate are energies, structure, correlation functions. This is something we can relate to the experimental spectrum, and also response property to get effective inertia and maybe say something about superfluid response. So there's one technical thing. The way we sample the exchanges of Bose-Einstein statistics is using the worm algorithm of Bonin-Zengi and Prokofiev. And this makes our code very efficient. So it's a very good method. So the spectrum. So the spectrum in those clusters is either a microwave spectrum. You come in with microwave radiation, and you couple the dipole of the system to the microwave field. You cause transition. Or an infrared spectrum, which also relates to the dipole. And in principle, it's easy to say, to propose a method to calculate the spectrum. You just need to calculate real-time quantum dynamics and calculate the dipole-dipole correlation function. But that's a very hard problem. We have a sine problem there. It's not a fermion sine problem. It's the real-time sine problem. We need to calculate the real-time propagator. So this method can only be use this real-time method when we have small clusters with one or two helium atoms, and then we do brute force diagonalization, solution of the Schrödinger equation. But when we go to large clusters, we cannot do real-time dynamics. We can only do imaginary time dynamics, and then you could do some sort of analytic continuation to go from imaginary to real-time, some inverse Laplace transform, and we do something of that sort to get the experimental spectrum. And I show you on the left how this would look. So you would get the results of our simulation. I denote them PIMC. And we can fit a model to our calculation to get the B constant or the effective inertia. If you could do the real-time calculation, you get an oscillating signal as opposed to some multi-exponential signal. So how does it look now for real molecules? So in path integral, we work in the position basis or position representation. So we see things clearly. So here's an N2O molecule that we are simulating. And in red, you have the oxygen, and in blue, the nitrogens of this N2O molecule. And around it are the helium atoms, but they're delocalized because of quantum effects. And in the path integral picture, they're represented by these polymers. And in our simulation, we simulate the positions and the shapes of those polymers for millions of times. We do these long simulations, and then we can get properties, thermodynamic properties. So the first one you can get is the density, that is the probability density of finding the helium in a certain region of space in the frame of this molecule. And you have interesting things. As you grow the size of the clusters, you get filling of shells and so on. And now this can be associated with the spectral features. So here is a case where we have an experiment from the group of Jaeger at Alberta, and we have a calculation from quantum Monte Carlo, and we basically have, for the B constant, perfect agreement with experiment. We even have a prediction. A year before the experiment, we predicted those spectral lines. So this tells us that our potential of interaction, our model, is very accurate. But it doesn't tell us much about why you get these oscillations and these inertias. So now what we need to do is to look at quantum statistics. So here what we do is that we do a calculation with Bose-Einstein statistics. So we recognize that helium-4 is a boson, and when you have many identical helium-4, wave function is totally symmetric upon exchange. But we can also neglect exchange and do Boltzmann statistics. And you have the experiment in blue triangles again, and you see that without exchange, you cannot capture the experimental phenomenology. So exchange is necessary to get the proper evolution of these effective inertia. Now, what about superfluidity? So to connect this to superfluidity, we need to use a two-fluid model. So I'll very briefly explain how we use this two-fluid model. Basically, we use this to get an effective inertia of the environment of the helium, and then we add this effective inertia of the helium to that of the dopant molecule to get the inertia of the complex, and this you can compare with experiment. And the effective inertia over the classical inertia gives you the normal fraction, and 1 minus the normal fraction is the superfluid fraction. And we use linear response theory to predict this inertia. So at the end of the day, after this derivation, the way we get the effective inertia of the helium about the rotation of the molecule is to project into its angular momentum, that of the helium, onto an axis perpendicular to the molecule. And now we can calculate the superfluid fractions. So we have as a function of system size a superfluid fraction, and we see for N2O it goes up. There's something special happening at 12. And we can convert this into rotational constants that can be compared to experiments, and we have a pretty good agreement, again, except for 12. We think this is because of quantum melting. We are at finite temperature. If you go to lower temperature, you will get more delocalization, more exchange, and the superfluid fraction should go up, and you get a better agreement here with the experiment. This allowed us to suggest in 2006 a measure from the experiment. We can propose a measure of the superfluid fraction, and this measure says that you take the experimentally measured transition frequencies, you turn it into an effective inertia, you compare that effective inertia to the classical inertia, and therefore you can get directly a superfluid fraction. And this experimental, in blue, superfluid fraction agrees very well with our predicted one, and we see that it goes up when the system becomes fully coated by the helium, and it can be a bit bumpy, and when you have a full solvation shell, we have a maximum. So this is an interesting way now to look at the experiments in terms of superfluid response. Yes? Later it will be when we talk about another system where we replace the helium by hydrogen. It will be some sort of double icosahedral structure. So yes, it is related to sphere packing at some point. Okay. But let me finish the helium story before getting into those details. So another thing we have about helium is that experimentally now there are experiments up to 70 helium atoms and even larger sizes, and you have these broad oscillations in the effective inertia, and those are not explained. So this is one of our outstanding questions. So far for helium, we have that the onset of superfluidity is when you have full coating of the molecule with the helium atoms, and that we have a maximum in this superfluid response when we complete a shell, and exchange is necessary to explain the experiment, but we don't know yet how to explain the oscillations, and also line widths. We don't yet know how to do the dynamics. Another question is, are there other superfluids? So we have helium-4 and helium-3 if you go very low, but is there another substance where you could just do an experiment and measure the superfluid response? So there's one candidate, which is parahydrogen. So parahydrogen was proposed as a superfluid in 1972, and various people have made theoretical predictions of superfluidity in parahydrogen. For example, separately did calculations in pure hydrogen clusters, calculated the superfluid fraction. But experimentally, there's not much evidence. There's a few signs in those papers of evidence of superfluidity, but no measure of effective inertia or the superfluid fraction. So why do we pick hydrogen? Well, next to helium is the next best thing. Hydrogen is light, but the interactions are a bit too strong, so it causes a lot of localization. That's why hydrogen freezes at 13.84 Kelvin. But we'll put it in a cluster, and we hope to kind of supercool it or prevent its freezing here. So what do we do? Well, we go and talk to our colleague experimentalists, and we try to see what there is known about the spectrum of hydrogen. And compared to helium, so helium is here in blue and hydrogen is in red, well, we can do the same kind of experiments, but there's much less data. So we have on the left vibrational shift. So this is the shift in the vibrational frequency of our probe. Here it's going to be CO2 that vibrates. Then we put around it some helium or some hydrogen, and it shifts its frequency. It changes its effective mass along the vibrational coordinate. And for helium, you have this nice blue shift and red shift and this size evolution. For hydrogen, it goes down, and then the data stops at about 8. For rotational constants, we saw before these beautiful results for helium. For hydrogen, it just drops and nothing happens. So there's no sign in existing experiments of possible decoupling or turnaround or superfluid response. So we collaborated with McKellar, who actually did these measurements here in the infrared, and we helped him assign his spectra. So to do that, we had to change our path integral code and methodology, because now we have hydrogen. Hydrogen is a molecule, it's not an atom. But we'll take para-hydrogen, where the nuclear spins of the protons are paired. So it's a sphere, it's an S state, so we can replace it by this green ball there. And it means that the way it interacts with CO2 is average, and with itself is also average. So we published some papers on the potential of interaction. And now what we want to do with this is to see if we can get a superfluid hydrogen measurement. And it would be a molecular superfluid as opposed to an atomic superfluid. Of course, it's all in a finite-sized system here. And so experimentally, this is the experimental spectrum. So with our calculations, they were able to assign the spectra for a broad range of cluster size. And what we calculate first is the vibrational shift. And we have the theory in the experiment. They agree very well. This means we have a good model of interaction. But the vibrational shift here doesn't tell us anything about superfluid response. It's just some spectral property. We also have magic numbers in the chemical potential as we grow the system size. And something special at 12 again. And we'll also have something special at 17. And so there's something interesting already appearing for hydrogen. So how does the system look? As you add to CO2 the hydrogen particles, let's say you put 5, they form a donut around the axis of the molecule. This is a reflection of the nature of the van der Waal interactions between H2 and the CO2 molecule. But as we keep adding particles, they do very interesting things. You would think they would fill shells. Sometimes they fill shells in a whole way, and sometimes they fill shells in a fractional way. And we found that when it's kind of fractional like this, we try to put numbers, although it's hard to draw the line between the regions, we have more exchange. So if a particle spends its time in two places, there will be more exchanges, and then we'll see that this increases the superfluidity. Also, on our chemical potential, this magic number at 12 here corresponds to the experimental, very stable in this blue region here, 12 size. So this is interesting. But when we arrive at 17, as was asked before, we have something very interesting. We get whole filling of certain regions around the CO2. So we have rings and caps around the CO2 molecule. And I will have a 3D picture of that on the next slide. So we have localization. So sometimes our clusters are delocalized, they're liquid-like, and sometimes they're solid-like, and sometimes they're kind of in between. And this can correlate to the spectrum. So now we have here our experimentally derived rotational constant. So we have the huge turnaround with a maximum at 12, so that's from experiment. And we did two calculations. We did one based on a two-fluid model of superfluidity, and we tracked very well all the qualitative behavior of that curve. We did also a dipole-dipole calculation, which is more of a direct golden rule type spectroscopy estimate, and we have the same behavior. So really, this experiment measures some sort of superfluid-like decoupling. And below, then, we can therefore calculate the superfluid response. And we see a maximum at 12. And so this is nice. So we have confirmed superfluidity in some substance other than helium, so in para-hydrogen. And here are the 3D pictures. We have at 12 that the system, where it's a maximum of superfluidity at high density, green means high density here, you have very delocalized rings of density. They're all connected, where you can have bosonic exchanges, but they're kind of separated from one another. If you go to low density, that's the gray area, then everything is connected. But for 17, where you have this sort of double icosahedral structure, you see three rings of 5 and one point here, another one, something in the center, then you have extreme localization and you lose the superfluid response. So we have a short-lived superfluid at finite size here. And now the question is, if you can maybe go to bigger cluster sizes, or maybe change the probe with something gentler to see if this superfluid can persist. So we've done that. So we took CO, and we just got the paper accepted here. And CO is like CO2, but you remove an oxygen, and then all the interactions are different. You have very weak van der Waal interaction. It's also lighter if you remove an atom, so its rotational constant is much bigger, it rotates faster. And then we can play the same game and predict vibrational shifts. It agrees well with experiments. It even helps the experimentalists assign their spectra. But now we have a problem. We probe two kinds of motion. We probe from the experiment overall rotation of the system and the inert rotation of the probe. And these are very different type of things. So we have a low-frequency microwave excitation, which is the overall rotation, and we have an infrared, we call it B-type transition, which is the hindered rotation of our probe. So we needed to set up a kind of a new kind of perturbation theory, a new way to think of this in the two-fluid model. And I won't go through the whole derivation here, but basically what we have from experiment is the green and the blue. One is from infrared and the other is from IR. And with an analogy to Stark, the Stark effect, we were able to derive a perturbation theory that tells us how to average the two experiments to get an effective rotational constant or an effective inertia, which is the black. And this effective inertia coincides very well with our patternable Monte Carlo calculation. So it is, again, a superfluid-like response from the experiment, but you cannot just look at one motion, you have to look at overall motion and individual probe rotation. And we ended up with a new experimental estimator of the superfluid fraction, although the superfluid fraction is almost 100% all the time. And very recently, we just submitted this. We put water inside the hydrogen, but now water rotates so fast that it's a very bad bucket, a very bad probe. It doesn't couple at all with our hydrogen. And what we see is that regardless how you treat water, you could treat it as a rotating molecule or non-rotating or as a sphere, the system has the same roughly chemical potential because water adiabatically separates its motion of rotation from the rest of the system. And I don't think I'll have time to get too much into those details, but basically what we see is that we have stable clusters at 12 and 18 for water, and they're based on icosahedral structures. And if you were to do the simulation at some different, well, I'll get to that later. I was about to say different temperatures. Later I'll show the temperature dependence. But if you look at the rotational correlation function, it's independent of cluster size. So if you were to do an experiment on a water molecule and a hydrogen cluster, you'd get the same spectrum as if you had one water molecule alone in a gas phase. The environment has no effect on it. And this is because it doesn't respond to the rotation of the water. And we've analyzed here, I'm going back to temperature, the temperature dependence of the superfluid fraction. And here we have the old separately results as the triangle with a big error bar, but nowadays we have faster computers, we can get smaller error bars, but roughly the same answer. For a pure hydrogen cluster, this is in red. And then we have for a dope hydrogen cluster, and this is in green. And what we see is that as a function of temperature, when you dope a cluster, because of localization effect due to the doping, the superfluid fraction drops much earlier for dope clusters. And it's even more dramatic when you have 18 plus one water. You almost completely kill the superfluid. So there's two superfluidities here. There's the response to a dopant, so it's some sort of susceptibility to the impurity. And there's a response to the lab frame or an external field, which is more the bulk response. And for a long time in the literature, there was a confusion about which is which and so on, and we have resolved it. And that the experiments, they don't probe the actual superfluidity of the system. They probe the response to the molecule. So they probe this response to dopant. That's the nature of those experiments, unless the dopant is a very long and heavy object. Until it becomes macroscopic-like, then you can have an equivalency between those two responses. And so what is next? So we are now working on water clusters and para-hydrogen and helium clusters, and we're also working on slower asymmetric tops to have a better probe of superfluidity. And with Roger Melko, our next speaker, we are working on the entanglement entropy between the rotor and the bosons to see if there's a correlation between this entanglement and the behavior of these rotational constants. And yeah, maybe one day I'll understand spin I. So we're working also on, well, we're thinking mostly about when we have water clusters, what happens if you have hydrogen and spins and so on. And we also want to explain these broad oscillations. And yeah, this is our start. We also work on clath rates. So this is a case where we look at the motion of hydrogens inside a water cage, but it would be interesting to look at what would happen if you allow the water to also move around and change their orientations here. And that's about it. This is the part of my group who worked on this, and these guys for funding, collaborators, and I thank you for your attention.